Major Simran III.
And suddenly she burst into tears and embraced me and said, "You're British soldiers, aren't you?" So I said, "Yes, I've been trying to get this through to you for the last 3 minutes or so. Why didn't you let on sooner that you can speak English? You can speak English very well, can't you?" So she says, "Yes, I am English. I was born in Manchester. I married a French farmer. We settled out here before the war." So I said, "Well, why has it taken you so long to let yourself known to me like this?" So she said, "Well, I had to make sure that you were genuine, that you were not German soldiers masquerading as British commandos and parachutists and testing us out, because they've been doing quite a lot of that around here recently. But if it hadn't been for your frightful schoolboy French and your back chat to your Yorkshire sergeant and soldiers, then I realised that the Germans couldn't have possibly have acted this part." And so that convinced me. So I said, "Oh, well, then, thank you very much. But anyway, are there any Germans around here in this area? Because your house is going to be occupied by us." So she said, "No." There were only a few Todd organization men who have been employed in constructing the fortifications on the beaches. So I said, "Thank you very much. I'll let our intelligence officer know about this, that you can speak English, know the area. I'm sure you'll be most useful. But I must dash." So off I went. You know, all in the casual conversation, as if we were on an exercise. To me, it was still, I still felt that this wasn't really war. This, everything up to now has taken place exactly as we had trained back in England. And I had no sort of fear of being shot at that time or anything. It was just like an exercise. So I went back and reported this to Major Stevenson, and then went forward to establish myself on what is known as a forward screen position on a hedgerow, 300 yards in front of the company position. And my little group was going to consist of two Bren gunners, two sergeants, a Piat anti-tank infantry weapon, a radio set, a 38 set, and a 6-pounder anti-tank gun, which was going to come up during the course of the night, and an FOB, a forward observation bombardment officer. He was a gunner captain who'd come off a cruiser offshore, HMS Arethusa, and he was going to shoot the guns of this cruiser onto the enemy when they came to attack us during the day. So he was a most important fellow. Wonderful. He was with me. So I had the gunner. He'd turned up. The anti-tank gunner was yet to turn up. I had no radio set. He hadn't turned, nor Piat infantry anti-tank. He hadn't turned up. I had two Bren guns and two sergeants. They had turned up. So that was my team at that time in the morning, about 2:30, and we started to dig in to the hedgerow. The hedgerow facing south towards Caen. And we had about an hour and a half of digging hard with our little entrenching tools and the odd pick and shovel. We weren't all supplied with pick and shovels. It was very hard digging in a hedgerow on a bank. But there was this ditch on our side of the hedgerow in which one could dig in reasonably comfortably. Anyway, we dug until dawn, and just before dawn, we heard this tremendous bombing barrage on the beaches behind us. The bomber command was really strafed up the beaches, and there was a continual roar of bombs landing there for about 20 minutes or so, and then suddenly all was quiet again. Just when dawn was breaking, the first thing that happened was a farmer with his little horse and cart came towards us from our front on a little track that joined up on the left side of our hedgerow, and we allowed him to come along right up to us, and suddenly two of my men leapt to their feet from the hedgerow and accosted him and found out that he was a harmless farmer, and we allowed him to carry on with his journey back to Le Bar de Ronville in Ronville. But it must have given him quite a fright to have us pouncing on him on a very quiet June morning. That was the first thing that happened to us. And then as the daylight became stronger and we were able to see further ahead in front of us, I got cracking with my captain, the gunner captain, the FOB, to get four defense tasks, artillery tasks, laid down in front of me, two in depth and two reasonably close. And he got those shots in from HMS Arethusa right on the four defense tasks. And the shells whipping over our heads, they were quite a experience. They sort of rushed over us and exploded on the right spot. So I had four gunner tasks, defense tasks, laid on nicely, all marked up on the gunner's map. And then quietness reigned again. And it was a quiet morning. We noticed the RAF flying around above us, the odd aircraft with their white striped wings, giving us cover from above. Nothing more than that, as we watched our front being very still in our little holes, watching our front and not moving. And then about 11 o'clock that morning, I noticed through my binoculars a group of about 50 soldiers debouching from a little copse about 400 yards in front of our positions. And they looked very much like our own lads. They had the round helmets on and camouflage smocks. And I thought perhaps they were a group of our own parachute soldiers who had been dropped afar and were coming in to join us. This group moved across my front from left to right, and then suddenly they deployed into extended line and advanced towards us through the fields. It was quite a long grass field, as high as the knee almost. So we allowed them to come closer and closer. This was all part of our drill, our plan. There was a little thin cattle fence in front of us, going parallel to our hedgerows, and we had planned that until they reached this cattle fence, we weren't going to open up on them. So they came closer and closer. And then when they reached the cattle fence, I fired my red Varilite pistol straight at the middle of them, and we all opened up fire, and the enemy went to ground. They were enemy, I realized that. They were coming at us in a threatening manner, and as they came closer, one could see that they weren't British parachuters. They all went to ground and disappeared from sight. And if you are lying at the base of a hedgerow and the grass is about ankle deep or a little bit more, the enemy just disappears from sight. One had to sort of stand up on the hedgerow, expose yourself to see any distance beyond the field. But anyway, we engaged them fire for a little while and then ceased fire. And I heard officers' orders in German working its way to my right, down towards the River Orne. And I thought, well, they were going down to their left, my right, and they were probably going to attack my position from the right side. And therefore, I sent up two red Varilite pistols to the right to let my company commander know that I thought the threat was coming in on the right from the River Orne end. This was a prearranged signal plan I had with my company commander because I was not in radio contact with him. My 38 set had not turned up. Incidentally, the 6-pounder had turned up during the night, and we had that established in our position, so I wasn't all that badly off. At least I had an anti-tank gun. Well, there was a pause, and we couldn't see any enemy at that time to shoot at, so we didn't shoot. And then suddenly, to our surprise, two self-propelled guns came towards our position from as if from nowhere, from dead ground in front of us. Two SP guns came side by side and stopped in front of our positions about 70 yards away, short of the cattle fence, and they started to systematically open up fire on my positions. And there was nothing we could do except keep our heads down. And I thought, what a wonderful target to myself then, what a wonderful target for our 6-pound anti-tank gun. Point blank range, nothing happened. And in the middle of this noise and explosions, a soldier came along the ditch on my right from the anti-tank gun position, crawling up to me on his hands and knees, and he saluted me on his hands and knees. And he said, "Sir, the gun's unserviceable. We can't get it to fire. It must have been damaged in the glider landing." And so I thought, well, heavens above, what does one say to that, you know? So I told this soldier to go back to his gun and open up with his personal weapons when he saw the enemy. I don't know at the time. I just spoke in this way. I felt a bit numb. It was very terrifying and unusual to have bullets whipping over you and shells going off. And there's such a lot of banging. They may have had some mortars opening up on our positions too, but there was a hell of a shindy around. But then, as happens in war, suddenly silence reigns. No more shooting, no more noise. And to my surprise, the hatch of one of the SP guns in front of me opened up, and out stepped a German officer, arrayed in his service dress, Sam Brown belt, peaked hat, leather shoes, boots, and he quietly got out of his tank and stood beside it and started to light a cigarette. He only had a couple of puffs, I think, but somebody in my section shot him, and he fell to the ground and disappeared from sight. I don't think we killed him, because later, when we walked around that area, there was no German officer bodies lying around. They may have taken him away. However, this was an amazing incident, to have a German officer acting like that. Then the next incident happened when my sergeant from the right-hand flank of my section came up to me and said that there were no more, and that he was the only one alive in his little area, and that he'd crawled up the ditch towards me, and he hadn't seen any signs of any of our lads, the anti-tank gun crew or the FOB. He was wounded. There was no sign of any movement at all, and he had run out of ammunition. What shall we do? And so I thought, well, there was no point in thought of staying here any longer. The attack was coming in from my right. We'd run out of ammunition. The anti-tank gun was unserviceable. The gunner, incidentally, I'm sorry I missed this out, that when the enemy was advancing to us over the fields, coming closer, I did call for fire to be put on them from my FOB. He got in contact with the cruiser, and he informed me, regrettably, they were on a priority target, and they couldn't give us any assistance. So I had no help from the cruiser. So at that stage, I thought, well, hell, there's nothing we can do here further. So I called out for any soldier around me who was alive to come and join me, and that I planned that we'd get the hell out of it. There was my batman, who had a nasty gap in his cheek. He had been shot in the face. There was a soldier on my right, dead, with his rifle up in the shoulder and pointing towards the enemy. And after this call, only this sergeant, my batman, and two other soldiers came to me, and I decided that the five of us would withdraw back to our positions. So this is what we did. We covered ourselves. There was no shooting at the time on our hedgerow position. The mortar fire that I'd hoped would come down on the enemy on my right from our own area didn't materialize. But anyway, the five of us withdrew back to our position. And on the way back to the C Company position, our own mortar fire came down quite strongly on the right flank of my hedgerow position. And this was a bit late, but anyway, our mortars did come down, and after they strafed that position for a while, they stopped. I reported to my company commander the situation there after I got back. Quietness remained in our hedgerow. There didn't seem to be any movement, so we decided to reoccupy the position again. So another section from C Company and I and the platoon commander went back to our hedgerow position, and we found that the enemy had withdrawn. I think our mortar fire had sent the enemy back, the infantry back, withdrew back along the River Orne. There was no sign of any infantry. And the two SP guns had moved out of its position and had gone around to their right towards B Company. And I gathered that an hour or so later, both SP guns had been shot and dispatched by the anti-tank guns from B Company. So we were able to reoccupy the forward hedgerow position in peace. There were one or two wounded around. Captain Gunner, was wounded in the thigh. Our stretcher bearers came up and we got our wounded back. There were quite a few dead. There was a dead German soldier in a little section of the hedgerow that went out from my left towards the enemy. We found a dead German there. So with the position reoccupied by another officer, platoon commander from C Company and his section and some Bren guns, I found myself at a loose end. So what I decided to do was to remove the dead. So I caught a couple of soldiers from C Company, and back in the Bar de Ronville we found a hand cart, and the three of us whipped this hand cart up to the hedgerow position, and we loaded up about four British soldiers, including a sergeant, Sergeant Milburn, he was killed, and the German. And with about four or five, I can't remember how many dead we had, about four or five, we went with this handcart back into Ronville, and I laid the dead along the cemetery wall by the church and returned back to the company. And indeed now, if you go back to Ronville and the church, you'll see that those who were killed early on D-Day, they're buried actually in the cemetery, the church cemetery, on a grassy bank along by the wall of the church cemetery itself, and not in the main cemetery field next door to the church, which is the military war cemetery. And I learned later that if men are buried in consecrated ground in a churchyard, then their bodies are not removed to a military cemetery elsewhere. They remain where they are. So we've got quite a few of our dead in the actual churchyard of the church. Well, for the rest of the day, remain reasonably quiet. The enemy did mortar us a lot, if I remember right, for the rest of the day. And then the mortaring seemed to die down and all became quiet. Then suddenly, about 9 o'clock in the evening, and it was still light, we heard the drone of heavy aircraft coming in from the sea, and we witnessed this wonderful sight of our bombers towing gliders, and the glider brigade, the airborne glider brigade landing on our dropping zone about 9 o'clock in the evening. They landed peacefully on our dropping zone. There was no enemy artillery fire on the dropping zone, and they just stacked up their gliders there as if they were coming into a car park. But the sight of these hundreds of gliders being let free from the bombers above us and circling around and coming in to land near Ronville was indeed a spectacular sight. So we had the arrival of the air landing battalions, which were the 12th Devons, the 1st Royal Ulster Rifles, and the Ochsenbachs, coming to join us on the evening of D-Day. The 12th Devons came, landed, I think, on the other side of the river, on the DZ on the other side, landing zone, on the other side of the Corps. But they came and relieved us in our positions, and we withdrew back into the Labarde of Ronville in a reserve position. The Royal Ulster Rifle Battalion, they went forward of our positions and occupied another little hamlet towards Caen called Longueval. And then in the next 2 days, plans were made for the Royal Ulster Riflemen to advance from Longueval to St. Honorine, widening our positions. And this little battle of the attack against Honorine, we were involved in because plans were made for us to advance south towards Caen to occupy Longueval and to give the Royal Ulster Riflemen support when they advanced from Longueval to St. Honorine. So I think it was D+3 found the battalion in single file advancing down the towpath of the River Orne and moving into Longueval to take over the Royal Ulster Riflemen's positions. And then the Royal Ulsters advanced across open fields towards St. Honorine. Unfortunately, the enemy by now were very strongly established in St. Honorine, and the Royal Ulster Riflemen failed in their attack, and they had to withdraw back into Longueval. And in this time, Longueval was very much attacked by mortars. Enemy mortars came streaming down into Longueval amongst us, the 12th. And of course, when the Ulstermen came back and joined us, we were in a very congested area with two battalions in this little village of Longueval being heavily mortared. And we suffered a number of casualties. We got quite a bashing in casualties in Longueval. But the plan was cancelled, and we had to withdraw back along the towpath, back towards Pegasus Bridge. And we did this in single file, lugging all our equipment and hoping that the enemy wouldn't shoot us up from the other bank, on the other side of the river, because we were very much exposed on that river towpath. Well, we were withdrawn past the Pegasus Bridge area and back to nearly our rendezvous quarries of the dropping zone. And there we stayed for a short time in reserve. The next day, and had a quietish night, the next day we were ordered to advance and reinforce the commandos in their positions on the wooded ridge in the Ompleville area. An evening move to join the commandos up there to give them more support in the Le Plain Ompleville area. And this we did without suffering any casualties. We only spent the night and half the next day with the commandos, when again we were told that to withdraw back to a rest area, back to the quarries on the River Orne, just north of the Pegasus Bridge. This was now about D plus 5, and the days, that day I remember there when we were resting in the quarries, was a wonderful day, and we had to reorganize ourselves because we had suffered quite a lot of casualties in Longueval and also up in our first positions when the enemy mortared us. I found that in C Company there were 3 officers left, company commander, 1 platoon commander, and myself as second in command. But B Company had only 1 officer left, and that was the company commander, Major Rogers. So I switched to support him. I switched to B Company. We were about, strength-wise, in A, B, and C Company, about 2 platoons each in the 3 companies. So here again I find myself in a strange company, knowing very few of the men. We were very pleased and overjoyed to have the tail party, the quartermaster and the cooks, and the heavy baggage, our big packs with our change of clothing and overcoats. They came and joined us. They had come across the channel by sea, and it was about D plus 5 when they reached us. And so we were able, by the riverbank, to change our underclothes, have a good wash, and also to have a cooked meal, the cooks arriving, a nice hot container evening meal. Rumour had it at that time that the battalion was destined to attack a place called Breville the following morning, and that we were to get our weapons cleaned and test our weapons and all that in preparation for this attack. This we did in the quarry. But after our evening meal, we suddenly got orders, and there was a bit of a rush. We were going to attack Breville that very, very evening. The CO whipped away for orders, disappeared from the quarry.